Welcome to our deep dive into George Orwell's 1984. We'll be using excerpts from the Gates of Imagination audiobook on YouTube to kind of uncover this chilling world that Orwell created. Given, some of the politically charged themes, I think our aim here is to really just analyze the ideas that are in the book and not, endorse any specific viewpoint.
Yeah, I think that's key. And it's important to remember 1984 wasn't meant to be a prediction, you know. It wasn't like Orwell was saying, "Hey, this is going to happen." It was really more a warning, right? Like he was deeply concerned about, the rise of totalitarian regimes in his time. He'd seen that and he was worried about the direction things were going. And I think he used this novel to really kind of explore like what could happen, you know. What are the potential consequences of just unchecked power?
Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit, right? So the audiobook excerpts we have, they really highlight just this oppressive atmosphere of Oceania. What really stood out to you?
Well, I mean, the way Orwell depicts surveillance through telescreens, right? I mean, it's incredibly effective. I mean, it's not just that they're watching you, it's that constant awareness that they could be watching you, and that's what creates this really pervasive sense of paranoia and fear. Like you never know who's watching or when they're watching. You're always kind of looking over your shoulder.
You see that so clearly in Winston.
Right.
Winston's actions, like he's hiding to write in his diary, almost as if he's committing a crime just by having his own thoughts.
Right. Yeah.
And then, there's that really just chilling line about thought crime, right? That thought crime, IS death.
Yeah, that line really gets to the heart of the party's control. It's not enough to just simply obey, right? Like you have to
Yeah.
believe, and to even think a thought that's contrary to the party's ideology is a death sentence, even if you never even speak it aloud.
It's like the party is trying to control reality itself, right? Which brings us to another key theme, I think, which is like the mutability of the past. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past, the party claims, right?
Right, and that slogan is so crucial to understanding how the party maintains power, because by constantly rewriting history to fit their current narrative, right, they then control the present, and in turn, they control the future as well.
And you see that so clearly in Winston's job at the Ministry of Truth, right? I mean, he's literally altering historical records.
Yeah.
He's erasing evidence, and he's fabricating these new narratives just to fit the party's agenda.
And it's a chilling example of how easily truth can be manipulated when those in power control the narrative. And remember that anecdote about the photograph, of Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford, even with concrete evidence that they were innocent,
Yeah.
Winston is forced to destroy that photo and perpetuate their guilt, you know?
It makes you wonder if any truth can survive in a society where the past is constantly being rewritten, right? But the party's control, it goes even deeper than that, doesn't it? Because they try to control language itself with newspeak.
Newspeak is designed to limit thought by shrinking the range of expressible ideas, right? So the goal is to make thoughts that challenge the party literally unthinkable.
And they have, like, they categorize the vocabulary into A, B, and C categories.
Yeah.
Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah.
Like, what's the deal with those categories?
So the A vocabulary, that's just the everyday words for, basic communication.
Okay.
B vocabulary is more politically charged. So you have, words like good think and minute true.
Ah, Minitrue. Calling the Ministry of Truth Minitrue almost makes it sound pleasant.
Exactly. It's designed to evoke, less critical thought than Ministry of Truth.
Right, yeah.
And then finally, you have the, C vocabulary, which is, technical jargon, for specific, fields and things. And that further limits your ability to express, more nuanced or complex ideas.
And then there's this concept of duck speak, right? Which is where language is reduced to just these like mindless slogans and pronouncements.
Right. And duck speak is like the ultimate goal of newspeak, right? It's to reduce language to just a tool of, obedience and conformity, stripping it of its power to question or to challenge.
So the party controls information, history, and even language itself. But amidst all this oppression, Winston, he sees this potential for rebellion in the proles, right?
Yeah, Winston he's drawn to the proles, right? Because they seem to have retained some of their basic human instincts and freedoms. They have families, they sing songs, they gamble on the lottery, all these things that the party members are forbidden from doing.
He even tries to like he tries to learn about the past from an old man in a pub, right?
Yeah.
Hoping to like find some shred of a different reality.
And that scene is particularly poignant, I think, because it highlights this tragedy of the proles, you know? I mean, they have this potential strength, you know, this connection to a past that the party's tried to erase, but they're also very easily distracted and kind of content with their simple life.
It makes you wonder, are the proles truly capable of rebelling? Or are they too controlled by the party's manipulations?
That's a question that hangs over, I think, the entire novel, you know? And it's one that we'll explore, you know, further as we kind of delve deeper into Winston's journey and the complex dynamics of this dystopian world that Orwell has created.
And speaking of Winston's journey, we can't forget about Julia. I mean, she's such a fascinating character.
Absolutely.
And their forbidden affair adds a whole new layer of complexity, I think, to this story.
Yeah, Julia's rebellion is much more personal and pragmatic, I think, than Winston's more intellectual, you know, kind of rebellion.
She understands the party's sexual puritanism as a means to control and direct people's energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And their secret room above Mr. Charrington's shop becomes this really powerful symbol of, you know, freedom and individuality in this world.
Yeah.
That's trying to crush both of those things.
Right. It's their haven. It's a place where they can be themselves, even if it's just for a little while.
Yeah.
And there's that beautiful image of the thrush, right? Almost hopeful image of the thrush singing in the clearing outside their window.
Right.
But, of course, we know that can't last forever.
No. The threat of betrayal and capture hangs over them from the very beginning, you know, and when it happens, I mean, the party's cruelty is truly terrifying. It's like the party's control is just so pervasive, you know, even these seemingly small acts of rebellion, like Winston and Julia sharing that, you know, real coffee and sugar, it just takes on this huge significance.
Right. Yeah, it's a powerful reminder, you know, that in a totalitarian state, like even the most basic human pleasures can become acts of defiance. And it's not just the physical pleasures, right? Like it's the emotional connection, the sharing of memories, the singing of that old rhyme about church bells, you know, that really struck me.
Oranges and lemons say the bells of St. Clement's. That rhyme, it becomes the symbol of a lost past, a connection to something authentic and beautiful that the parties tried to erase.
Right. It makes you wonder, like, what would you be willing to risk, right, for a taste of real coffee or a moment of true connection in a world like that?
Mm-hmm.
But their rebellion, as brave as it is, kind of plays right into the party's hands in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember how, like, Orwell lays out the party's structure in the book. He calls it the theory and practice of oligarchical collectivism.
Yeah, yeah. That mouthful of a title, it describes the blueprint for how the party maintains its power, you know, through this rigid social hierarchy. You have the inner party, the outer party, and then, of course, the proles, you know. And by keeping these groups separate and unequal, the party prevents any kind of solidarity or organized rebellion.
Right. So it's like this classic divide and conquer strategy.
Exactly.
But the party's control goes even deeper than that, right?
Exactly.
Like they use war, they use propaganda, and perhaps most insidiously, they use doublethink to manipulate people's minds. So can you maybe explain doublethink a little further for our listener?
Yeah. So doublethink is the ability to hold two contradictory beliefs in your mind at the same time and accept both of them as true, right? So it's about deliberately rejecting logic and reason and just embracing the party's version of reality, no matter how absurd it might seem.
So it's more than just like lying, you know, or pretending to believe something that you don't. It's like, it's about actually believing two opposite things at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a form of mental conditioning that allows the party to constantly shift the narrative and maintain control. And it's not just limited to Oceania, right? Like think about examples of doublethink that you see in the world today. Like how often do we encounter, you know, conflicting information or we encounter these situations where we're being asked to accept something that just contradicts our own logic or experience.
Right. It's a chilling thought. And this is the world that Winston's trying to rebel against, right?
Mm-hmm.
And despite the dangers, he takes a huge risk by reaching out to O'Brien, who he believes is part of the Brotherhood, this kind of legendary resistance movement.
Yeah, and that meeting in O'Brien's apartment, it's such a turning point in the novel, you know? It's both a moment of hope, but it's also this foreshadowing of Winston's ultimate downfall.
Right. Like O'Brien turns off the telescreen, he offers them wine, he toasts to Emmanuel Goldstein, you know, the supposed leader of the resistance. It seems like Winston has finally found like an ally within the inner party.
But it's all a carefully constructed trap.
Right. You know? O'Brien is a master manipulator, right?
Yeah.
He's playing on Winston's desperation for, you know, hope and connection.
And then the shattering of the glass paperweight, the hidden microphones, the SWAT police bursting in. Oh, that scene is so intense.
It's the moment, you know, when Winston's world just comes crashing down and his journey, it takes this really dark turn into the depths of the Ministry of Love.
And the torture that unfolds there, it's both physical and psychological, right?
Yeah, Orwell doesn't, you know, shy away from depicting the brutality of the party's methods, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. The descriptions of the torture, they're visceral and disturbing, but they're essential to understanding the true nature of this totalitarian regime.
Right. And there's that chilling exchange, I think, where O'Brien tells Winston that reality only exists in the human mind, right? Mm-hmm. Implying that the party has the power to just reshape reality itself. It's a terrifying concept, but it's one that has these disturbing parallels in our own world, right? I mean, think about the way that information is controlled and manipulated today, the rise of disinformation and propaganda. Like, how do we even know what's real anymore when the very nature of truth is constantly being challenged, right?
It's a question that Winston grapples with, you know, as he endured the party's just relentless torture.
Yeah.
But it's not just physical pain that they inflict, you know.
Yeah.
They also use psychological manipulation to just break him down and force him to betray his own beliefs.
Right. And that's what makes Room 101 so terrifying. It's not just a place of physical torture. It's a place where they confront you with your deepest, most primal fear. And in Winston's case, it's rats.
Oh, that scene it's so hard to stomach, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's such a crucial turning point in the novel because it's where Winston finally breaks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In his desperation to escape the rats, he betrays Julia, begging them to do it to her instead.
Yeah, it's a moment of complete and utter despair. And it's this stark reminder of the party's power to just crush even the most fundamental human bonds, you know.
And from there, Winston's transformation is truly horrifying. I mean, he doesn't just break. He comes to accept the party's version of reality, embrace doublethink, even love Big Brother. It's like a chilling reminder that even when faced with just unimaginable horrors, you know, the human spirit can be broken.
Yeah.
And that's I think what makes the ending of 1984 so impactful.
Yeah, it's not a happy ending, right? But it's a powerful one. The final scene, you know, with Winston sitting in the Chestnut Tree Cafe, staring up at the telescreen, completely absorbed in the party's propaganda. I mean, it's both heartbreaking and thought-provoking.
He's become everything that he once despised.
Right.
And that final line, he loved Big Brother. I mean, it's like a punch to the gut. It shows the complete triumph, you know, the party's ideology, the complete erasure of Winston's individuality. Yeah.
And I think what makes it even more unsettling is that Winston's transformation isn't, you know, presented as this like unique or extraordinary thing. It's almost like it's inevitable, you know? It's like this natural outcome of the party's just all-encompassing control.
So where does that leave us? Like, what are we supposed to take away from this bleak, you know, dystopian vision?
Well, I think 1984 serves as this like cautionary tale. It's a warning, right? About the dangers of unchecked power and the importance of, you know, safeguarding our own freedom of thought. It forces us to confront, you know, the potential consequences of complacency, of, you know, allowing ourselves to be manipulated by those who seek to control not just our actions, but our very thoughts.
Yeah, it's a heavy message, but it's a crucial one, especially in our own time.
Absolutely. I mean, as we navigate this, you know, increasingly complex world, you know, where technology gives those in power these unprecedented tools for surveillance and control, the lessons of 1984, I think, feel more relevant than ever.
Orwell wasn't just writing about, you know, this fictional dystopia. He was highlighting, I think, the dangers inherent in any system that seeks to suppress, you know, individuality, critical thinking, the pursuit of truth.
And that's why it's so important to be aware of those dangers, to be critical of, you know, the information that we consume and to resist any attempt to limit our freedom of thought.
So what can we do? How can we, like, as individuals, push back against these forces and ensure that Orwell's dystopian vision doesn't become our reality?
Well, I think it starts with awareness, right? We need to be aware of the ways in which power can be used to manipulate and control, to be critical of, you know, the narratives that we're being fed, and to seek out diverse perspectives.
Right. It's about engaging in critical thinking, asking questions, not accepting things at face value.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's about being willing to, you know, challenge the status quo, to speak out against injustice and to defend the values of freedom, of truth, and individuality.
Right. It's about remembering that even in the darkest of times, there's always hope.
Think back to that image of the parole woman, you know, hanging laundry in the courtyard, singing her heart out despite the hardships that she's, you know, facing. It's a reminder that even in the face of oppression, the human spirit can endure, and that small acts of defiance, they can, you know, plant the seeds for change.
It's a powerful image, and one that I think offers a glimmer of hope amidst the darkness. So as we wrap up our deep dive into 1984, I want to leave you with this final thought.
The world that Orwell created may be fictional, but the dangers that he highlighted are all too real.
So it's up to each of us to be vigilant, to be critical thinkers, and to fight for a future where freedom of thought and individuality prevail. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it's given you some food for thought and inspired you to continue exploring the complex and challenging world of 1984.